Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show, hosted by author, investor, money partner, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris, equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, this is Bruce Norris. Welcome to our show. Today we're joined by Aaron Crown. He is the creator of the website, The Mortgage Lender Implodometer, and it's a very popular site that's been looked at some 12.5 million times in 2007. I visit it every day myself. Aaron, welcome to our show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Aaron, give me a little background on yourself. What did you do prior to the lender implodometer idea? What did you do for a living, and how did you come up with this idea?
Well, I was actually a computer scientist doing research on grant projects. I worked at Emory University in Atlanta, and I actually continued doing that for the first half of the year with the implodometer being run on the side, increasingly requiring more people to be brought in to help out with it. But I did finally decide to leave my job at Emory and work on the implodometer and other similar websites full time. So having a go at that now.
Okay.
But, so I came from basically computer science, IT, that kind of background. And for me, the economics, investing, finance was a side interest, a big side interest, but something I did on the side nonetheless. And just from learning about the economy, looking at the economy, trying to understand how the market worked, that drew me to real estate by mid-2006. And I came to see real estate is central to the American economy and kind of the linchpin of the economy with, housing finance really at the center of it all. And that's why I started looking at these imploding lenders and started the site to track it because I just thought it was important. I didn't see anyone else really tracking it and trying to draw attention to it so that people could understand what was going on. So that's kind of my take on it, is that it's important macroeconomically. I think it does really bear on everybody. I mean, it influences everyone, that the housing market is so key to the economy.
Absolutely. Now, what area do you live in, and do you own a home?
I live in Atlanta, Georgia. And,
okay.
I ended up not buying. I was looking at buying a condo in 2005, and I ended up moving. I was renting the condo because I just didn't think the price was reasonable. I would have had to get some exotic loan, and I didn't know that much about mortgage lending at the time, but it just, the options did not look very good for getting a loan with very little money at that point, just a few years out of college.
Okay.
I know a lot of my peers were getting places with little or no money down, and I just wasn't going to do that. So I basically opted to sit the market out then, and I didn't think much of it at the time. I was interested in finance, but I basically came back to the housing market a year and a half later, realizing just how crazy it was. So, no, I don't own. I'm waiting for the right time, basically. Buyer's market is likely to be for another couple of years.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll have your opportunity, no doubt about that.
I think so.
How many lenders have imploded since you started keeping track?
Well, I don't know the exact answer to that, but I know that we've got about 160, 161 lending operations on our list.
Okay.
And there are doubtless more. There are many others that are on our screen, on our backlog, that we need more information on, basically, to be able to make a definitive call. A lot of work goes into that, and there's a lot that's just, we haven't gotten around to posting yet.
How do you...
Needs more confirmation. So it's definitely more than the 160 you see there. And it's not just lending operations either. There's smaller shops and brokerages and so forth that have all been impacted and affected by this, realty shops as well. The impact is quite wide.
Any idea how many jobs would have been lost due to the closures of these lenders? Have you ever calculated any of that?
Well, I don't have a very good estimate. That's one of the harder details to confirm. From just what's on the list, I think I had estimated a fairly wide range of 50 to 200,000 jobs.
Okay, yeah, that's a pretty wide range. Okay,
yeah.
Let's go back and talk about the beginning of this whole problem. Let's say I'm a subprime lender in 2005. What were the qualifications? What was the qualification process to obtain a subprime loan back then?
Well, not much is my impression of it. Apparently, a lot of even stated income. Actually, just from looking at your reports on some more of the details, I was shocked by the extent to which subprime was really ARM centric. I hadn't realized is the vast majority of subprime loans were adjustable. So apparently, there was not much, qualification of whether the buyer would be able, or the borrower would be able to afford the loan at the fully indexed rate.
There was no attempt was made at that at all.
Yeah. I mean, it was ridiculous. And what drove it, which is my understanding at this point, is that you had competition. The FHA and so forth, the government backed lenders had heavy competition from the private sector, and the private sector was being fueled by the Wall Street finance, the wildcat finance, and kind of anything went. And so, if you couldn't get your loan funded through one of the old kind of stodgy methods, you just go down the street to own it and get the same thing, and then a lot of lenders just capitulated and dropped their own underwriting standards.
The other part of that, in major, let's say, state like a California, where prices just completely exceeded the FHA loan limit, so it wasn't even an option. I think that's what also started the conventional side being very popular. FHA is something like 362 in California, and the median price got up to about 580. So it became almost a non-factor at all.
Right, and I think a lot of that emanated out of California and Florida. And once they started, and once they put the system together in those states to get around those statutory limits, why not, branch into other states and then just start poaching business from the conventional sorts of mortgage lenders? I think a lot of that happened.
When these lenders made a bunch of these loans, what's your understanding of how they originally funded them?
How they originally funded them.
Did they have credit lines that they made available to them, and they funded them that
right.
way?
Right. So you're talking about the past couple of years?
Yeah, just...
I think that in the vast majority of the cases on the implodometer, they really were not capitalized at all. These companies had essentially no capital. And so they funded the loans in the short term with warehouse lines provided by banks, sometimes big Wall Street money center banks, sometimes regional banks. I think a lot of medium-sized banks really got involved in the housing bubble and in funding some of this stuff. And so that's how they pushed the business through. And as long as everything was going great, the loans were getting sold off onto the secondary market, and then it was just, bye-bye, nice knowing you. Don't have to worry about those again. And that continued until the loans were so bad that they started having these early payment defaults and just going bad on their first payment in many cases. And a significant percentage of the loan pools went bad like that. And then they couldn't just kiss them goodbye. They had to buy them back. And, since a lot of these companies had essentially no capital, they couldn't afford to buy them back. So it was just instant bankruptcy.
What percentage makes up a significant percentage when you say a significant percentage of defaults?
I think just 1 or 2% doing early payment defaults like that would be enough to squash a lot of these companies.
That's correct.
And of course, the delinquencies we're seeing are growing beyond that, but that's just early payment defaults.
Okay, who were the buyers then of these loans? If I'm a subprime lender and I put these in a credit line, who exactly is buying this paper? And ultimately, I guess, who's the bag holder if, in fact, they default?
Oh, that's what the world is trying to discover now. And I think the answers to that have been there's, I guess, three major parties. You do have the money center banks and the banking industry in general is holding on to a lot of this. And I think that's even a surprise to them because they were selling these loans to each other, these loans pools, through the secondary market and just kind of flipping them back and forth. So the banks actually do own a lot of it. Foreigners who were buying U.S. bonds just to park large quantities of dollars coming from the trade deficits were ending up owning a lot of these loans. I know the Chinese had admitted that they had at least 10 or $20 billion in subprime pools, and of course it's probably much larger than that. And then you have things like pension funds, splendidly enough, who were doing pretty much the same thing, kind of chasing higher yields on these subprime securities and the CDOs and all that. So I think those are the three major parties, and nobody's very happy about it.
Well, you know, a pension fund can only invest in a AAA rated investment. So how did a pool of subprime loans, which really didn't get qualified for, ever obtain that AAA rating?
Right. That's one of the key points in what has made this a financial crisis, I think. And it came as a surprise to me because I just didn't know much about the machinery that was powering the bubble, really, on the under the hood.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was that they used some of these exotic financial instruments that were invented around the early and mid-90s, but really didn't gain much use until after 2001, when we had a lot of those low interest rates and the dollar recycling from China and so forth. There was this need to chase higher yields. So what they apparently did was they came in and they used CDOs, or produced these structures called CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, where they basically sliced the loan pools into different risk tranches. And of course, that's the first point where mistakes can be made, right? And then what they did is they took the low-rated tranches and they added a little bit of insurance in the form of derivatives. And that's the second point where mistakes can be made, because you don't know that the you bought enough insurance. You don't know that the counterparty actually is capitalized well enough to provide that insurance. So there's layer upon layer of questionable assumptions in these. But what they did manage to achieve in the short term was to produce a AAA rating. And their ratings agencies signed off on these and said, okay, well, this looks good to us. You claim it's well protected. You claim that the risk has been estimated properly. So, AAA stamp, and it went out into the market. And these loans, these CDOs, they look to buyers, pretty much the same as your typical blue chip AAA corporate debt. And they were being bought and sold in the same markets, but had a little bit higher yields. So it looked like a win-win, but of course, in that kind of situation, you should always be suspicious, and far too many people and large-scale buyers of loans did not get sufficiently suspicious, and so this stuff spread far and wide.
Mm-hmm. One of the
now
reasons
people are realizing this, that those AAAs really were not real.
Well, one of the things that masked their risk was the past payment history, and it's pretty easy to have a block of mortgages that are lousy keep their payments current when they're going up by 20%. But as soon as that stopped, and it was evident that these people should have never been able to get the property that they bought.
I think it's going to get worse as well, because it's not just subprime. And you guys are definitely intimately aware with this, judging by your report, is that the fact of being overextended extends to all borrowers through the credit tranches, up to people with 750 credit scores could have been overextended just as well as someone, with a 620. And a lot of that was going on. A lot of these Alt-A loan pools really are going bad pretty quickly. I read a piece a few weeks ago or a few days ago that Moody's is treating a lot of these pools as if they're subprime pools. And, we know what's going on with some of these. There are things like pay options in there, where you can just choose not to pay the full amount of the loan for a short period of time if you can't afford it. And that works until you run into the negative amortization limit. So it's kind of like there's some ticking time bombs that are still out there in the market, and the market is not ready for it. It does not have the tools to deal with it.
Well, one of the things that's really in California that's happening, let's say you had an Alt-A borrower. This is an exact example of something in Corona, California, where a purchase was accomplished for $1,250,000 with no down. They even stacked the closing cost on top of the second. So somebody must have had one nice FICO score and a good stated income story, but 9 months later went to sale, and now the property is for sale in the MLS for $875.
Right.
The problem with that is if we pulled up the neighborhood just for fun to see what the average loan balance was for the neighborhood, and it's over $1 million.
Right.
So the problem that we're not experiencing yet, but we inevitably will, is when those payments have an adjustment that is uncomfortable for the people, whether it's an alt A or you reach that limit, like you had mentioned, where you're now over the comfort level of the lender, somebody's going to have to try and refi. And the only way they're going to get a refi is to put in a very sizable check to get their payment down. Since you're not as familiar with real estate, every state's different in the sense of how the loans are structured. One of the damaging things in Florida, for instance, is all the loans have recourse. So when I just talked to a guy yesterday who had 24 foreclosures in process, he was an investor that was able to buy 24 Florida homes with no down and stated income. All of those loans, though, have teeth. They can go after everything he has.
Right.
In California, that's not true. Mm-hmm. We actually just can walk away from any purchase money. So the lenders get left holding the bag all the time.
Well, and this is part of what's created the toxic situation in terms of recovering from the mess, is that investors don't really know what they have in these pools, and they don't know what their recourse is for recovering that. They don't know, and borrowers aren't really sure what to do to work the situation out. So there'll be a lot of business for lawyers in the coming years.
Yeah, they will be a busy group. I think one of the groups will be busy talking to the rating agencies that managed to stamp a AAA on what was not anywhere close to that. As far as the lenders that have been that's made your list, what percentage would you say are subprime lenders of the ones that have not stayed open?
I would say it's below 30%.
Okay.
We have been imploding, so to speak, alt-A lenders mostly since May, approximately. And that's what started giving me pause around then about whether this was just a subprime problem. It appeared to me clearly to be a problem with borrowers being overextended and prices being too high, having very little to do with the different risk tranches. So, and I think that's very much the case, and there's more to come, from things like these pay options and just from values going down and probably some job loss ramping up.
Yes.
Some of which is actually starting from the housing industry. It went up, it flew the highest, and it's going to be the first to turn the other way. And there's a significant number of jobs being lost in housing finance, home building, furnishings, all those things that went along with the bubble expanding and people having this apparent wealth and the wealth effect and the ability to cash out home equity and things like that, that's all going into reverse.
One of the interesting things about the real estate industry is you can have what seems to be still the same amount employed, but they're making 50% of what they used to make. That's very common in California. So we're doing maybe 350,000 transactions. That's our newest pace, and we're doing 650. So somewhere along the line, somebody's missing nearly 50% of their income across the board, and yet they seem to be fully employed.
Oh, yeah, and brokers and loan officers and all those groups also, their actual income will go way down. It has gone way down. I've heard from a lot of these people, and I've heard from actually a sizable contingent of mortgage banking that actually are themselves going through loss mitigation, pre-foreclosure process.
Sure.
Because, their income has fallen off a cliff, and they went pretty high up there on the housing ladder, they say in the UK.
It seems like many foreign countries have been dragged into the drama as well. They've invested in these instruments. Do you see that as a problem that could have some longer-range ramifications?
Yeah. My understanding of it at this point is that basically the whole Anglosphere kind of fell under the spell of the housing bubble and kind of allowed it to get out of hand because it was just really convenient. It created this apparent wealth and everybody liked it. It was intoxicating, so it was just allowed to happen. And of course, there's a little little bit outside the Anglosphere. You know, Spain has a housing bubble as well, but you know, Australia, the UK, probably Canada to some extent will all see the downside of the recent upside. So it probably is nowhere as extreme as it got in the United States for a variety of reasons. But I do expect a significant impact in all of those countries.
Is there a common theme on how a lender implodes? In other words, is there a process? Because you sort of have a waiting list and then you have an actual list. So is there a process that you've become familiar with going, okay, there's the warning sign, and sure enough, it closes?
There are signs, there are signals. You know, we start hearing from people about layoffs. You know, sometimes we hear about buybacks. Failure to meet payroll is a big one. There's a number of signals like that. You know, we keep things on file when we start hearing about that, and then wait for some sort of more public announcement. So, the information does get out. And most of these rumors about collapsing lenders do ultimately prove to be true. And it's not much of a surprise because, you know, just the whole trend of the industry is reversing. And a lot of these companies, they didn't exist in their current scale before a few years ago. They really started accelerating after 2001 or 2003. And so it's not that much of a surprise that they'll essentially go out of existence. But it's, you know, no less painful for people because they're depending on companies like that for their jobs.
It seems like the government has come to the rescue and, you know, they've lowered rates and they've created some liquidity in the market. What's your feeling on how successful that will be?
I think it'll be an utter failure. I think what they're doing in many cases is really trying to just paper things over, and they're not even making much of a go at doing that seriously. I think I actually happen to know that the calls are being made around frantically to the industry by the government. They're trying to figure out what they can do to prevent a large-scale disaster with people, you know, being thrown out of their homes from mass foreclosures. But, you know, things like Bernanke lowering the interest rate, that was such a, you know, punch to the gut of the dollar that it caused the bond market to go up, or the yields in the bond market to go up, so that, you know, long-term rates, which impact mortgages, just went up. So it actually makes fixed financing even more difficult. So that really was not overall good for the housing market. What that was really done was to provide short-term financing for the money center banks that find themselves in trouble trying to finance a lot of these loan pools and move them around and do things like LBO financing and, you know, the money market conduit financing. All these things have been really impacted by that core problem, which is that these loan pools polluted the AAA rating and polluted the money markets. And so there's a mass loss of confidence in the money markets, and the Fed is frantically trying to repair that. But it hasn't solved fundamental problems with borrowers being overextended. It's basically pushing on a string, that old term they use for the Fed. Mm-hmm. When there's a crisis, you know, they can provide more short-term liquidity, but they cannot force especially foreigners to come back into the U.S. Fixed income markets.
Absolutely. A little bit of trust has been lost, no doubt about that. Aaron, we only got a minute left in this segment. What is the website address that people can get directed to?
Sure. It's ml-implode.com, or if it's easier for you to remember, go to mortgageimplode or lenderimplode.com, both of those one word.
Okay. I visit it every day just to get my fix.
Yeah, we keep the news coming. I mean, it's the latest of the crisis, basically.
It is. It's probably become very famous at this point. 12 million hits. I bet there's a lot of repeat customers like myself. So thank you for joining us, and we'll cover some other interesting topics in our next show.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or email questions and or comments to radio@thenorrisgroup.com. We'll see you next week at 5:30 here on News Talk 590 KTIE.